tsunami's back, bitches.
Took you long enough.
This has been an experience we will never forget.
This ain't no time to go all mushy.
Don't lecture me. I've waited long enough.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 464 of the Toonami Escape Podcast. I'm C. Kohler, and with me tonight is Seda.
Hello.
And Crocodile.
Good evening.
Well, we've got a little bit of news to talk about this week before we get into the rundown. The big one, I don't want to talk too much about this personally, but let's just get the elephant in the room out there about the fact that it's now more likely than it was before that Paramount may purchase WB.
Yeah, there was also reports about, you know, what sorts of cuts might be planned in terms of budget if Paramount, if once this acquisition goes through. Now, there are no, like, specifics, and this is all just sort of, like, you know, nothing officially announced, just kind of, like, you know, reporting on what people hear and talk about and whatnot. So yeah, that's just, it's just speculation at this point, which is probably why Seacolor doesn't want to talk about it too much, because, like, who knows? But, you know, if Paramount acquires all of these WB properties and then they start having to, you know, trim, like, do they look at Adult Swim and be like, do we need this? I don't know.
Not to get too much into politics here, federal regulators are likely to be pretty lax on the situation. State regulators might have something to say about it, as well as international ones. So, we'll see how it goes through. Like, this involving a lot of debt. This is kind of like still up in the air. But yeah, like, if a merger is going to happen, it looks like it's likely going to be Paramount versus WB. And that could have a significant number of downstream effects on, of course, the stuff we talk about. From the last merger, Toonami bounced back, but it was basically frozen in stasis for a good while. We don't know once, if this merger goes through, we don't know if there's going to be a freeze and then Toonami will bounce back, or if this is, you know, the death knell for Toonami or Adult Swim more broadly. We just don't know. But that's how things are playing out right now, and we'll just have to wait and see.
Yep, pretty much. So there you go. We'll just wait and see. At the moment, nothing has changed. And probably, even if that goes through, I still think it would take a while for things to change. So
yeah, it's a slow process.
The other piece of news I had was we did have a game review this weekend, and that was for a game I had not seen before called Skate Story. And it's a, what was it? It was like you're a guy who was trying to skate out of hell.
Yeah, it's I haven't played this, but I've heard that it's got like a ridiculous premise or something like that. I'm looking on the Steam page right now, and it's overwhelmingly positive. So, Toonami doesn't think so. They just think it's an 8 out of 10. But
yeah, the way they were talking, I expected them to actually give it below an 8 out of 10. But Toonami, what would you do if they? I don't know. Hell would freeze over if you gave something other than 8 out of 10, no matter how much they gave it a glowing or subpar kind of read through or whatnot.
Yeah, I now that you're mentioning it, I do remember the review. They were like criticizing the fact that it had too much story and not enough skating.
Yeah, they were more. They weren't saying like the game was terrible at all, but they were definitely criticizing it more than I recall them criticizing most games during most reviews. So I was actually expecting, oh, this might be actually a 7.5 or a 7 or something of that sort. But nope. One thing I would say though. Skate Story seems like a very generic pedestrian name for a game that's about a dude made out of glass skating in hell. You'd think it'd be something spicier, like, obviously you can't call it Hades, that's already taken, but you know, Hell Skater or something, I don't know, something other than Skate Story. That feels like a bit of a fumble on the part of the developer, but obviously I don't know why they named the game the way they named it, but you expect something spicier given what the game was apparently about.
I like the graphics, though.
I'm reading the, just like the blurb of how they describe this game, and it's skate fast to destroy demons and save other tortured souls on your journey from fragile beginner to hardened skater. Like, wow, that sounds hardcore for a skate game.
It's creative. I'll give them that. All right. That's pretty much it news-wise. So, unfortunately, I took a little bit more notes this week than I normally do, so hopefully that doesn't make this go overly long. But let's get into the rundown. We'll begin, of course, with Primal.
Hey,
Primal, Season 3, Episode 7, Heart of the Undead. Gee, I wonder what they're talking about. So Fang carries Mira and the kid back to the village. I obviously didn't really believe she was going to die, but I thought the possibility was there she was going to. But of course, that doesn't happen. She doesn't die. After she's back, Spear comes tromping into the village and everyone attacks him and then he runs away. And we kind of get this twice. He comes back later during a storm, gets chased away again. And then he sort of hangs out in the mud after that. And then that's when Mira finally wakes up and she's better. Although her leg is like, she has a limp now.
She's got like a twisted ankle or maybe something more severe. But yeah, her leg is up.
Oh, I saw this. I wrote this down. The closed captioning, it named that kid. The kid's name is Jabu. I was like, oh, that's interesting. We'd never know that otherwise.
Yeah, we should, right.
But anyway, Jabu explains what happened to Spear. They kind of do like a little pantomime, like all the stuff that happened.
And Mira, even though she was like just, you know, woke up from, you know, an injury and is, you know, very pregnant, like, I am off.
Yeah, and Fang is still doing the, like, motherly, like, oh, don't go out there, it's too dangerous for you, but goes anyway.
Up to this point, I obviously, Spear's a zombie, like, that, you know, all that entails, obviously people aren't necessarily going to take to him. I had expected that perhaps the villagers would have remembered, oh yeah, Spear, you're so awesome in life, like, what the hell happened? Maybe it would be less judgmental, more like, okay, this is fucked up, but not necessarily going to, like, do a mob hunt or whatnot. But I think someone explained that they didn't take him back to their own village, but rather took him to another village where they wouldn't have known Spear when he was alive. And at least that made sense to me. Like, oh, okay, that explains kind of the, again, he's a zombie, so it's going to be a harsh reaction, but you'd think there'd be some kind of what happened or some, you know, questioning of what, you know, the man he knew as a hero in life. But if it's just a bunch of different people, that explains a lot.
Yeah, I think that's the most likely scenario as well. Well, we come back from the commercial break. Spear wakes up from in the next morning and he's covered in mud. He goes take a shower in the waterfall. He kind of sees his reflection. And we get this really interesting sequence here. There's a couple of them in this episode where he's battling his demons.
Over the course of this season, he's like gaining his like self-realization more so, like, back, and he's like starting to remember, you know, who he was at one point, and he sees like the reflection of his earlier self, and then he like sees, you know, the reflection of his current self, and for a moment he's actually like, you know, shocked by it, and then he kind of puts two and two together, kind of slowly piecing together, like, oh, these, you know, my appearance, that's why these people are attacking me, you know, yelling at me or attacking me or worse. And so he's like starting to realize more and more like the position he's in. Whereas before he was kind of like completely brainless, and he's like starting, you know, gears are starting to turn about his current situation. And then the next part of the scene is when he's like, there's like a scene with him and like a spirit Fang, like not the real Fang, but like kind of a vision of that he's seeing.
Yeah. It kind of continues on for a while. And he's like, The spirit Fang or the reflection Fang is kind of, you know, mad at him and chasing him, and he's having memories back when he was good with Fang, but now it's bad, and he's kind of getting frightened, and he ends up running out, and he kind of falls into a river. He's swept up by the river and the current, and then ultimately goes over a waterfall.
Yeah, I think this is like the first time that this whole sequence is really first time we really got a sense that like Spear is kind of getting the self-awareness to understand that I used to be someone, like, he's been having his memories coming back slowly. This is kind of the culmination of he's understanding, this is who I used to be, this is who I am now, and I've lost. And Spear, of course, was like one of his best friends, basically. So all of that, Fang was one of Spear's best friends. So all of that's kind of hitting him, and it's just he's having a bit of identity crisis, and obviously it's kind of affecting him physically as well, which I think anyone would be, I think it's a totally understandable process and kind of what he's going through is maybe not necessarily relatable because people don't tend to turn into zombies since they're not real life, but the whole thing of like, I've lost everything, I've lost who I am, and that's, I can't take it. That's very relatable at least. So yeah, understandable on his part.
Yeah. And as you're talking, I'm kind of remembering, correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like at the end of that scene, he was kind of fed up. Like, or am I remembering right that he was like, oh no, this is like, he was kind of almost giving up.
I think I remember him falling, or I don't think he like tried to commit suicide. I think he fell and then he was just like in a panic and then washed over the waterfall. I don't think I remember him trying to commit suicide, which is obviously something that we'll talk about later in a different show. But
yeah, I don't think he like gave up, but he's, you know, kind of, it's a little bit manic where he's just trying to like you put in your notes, battle his own like inner demons as he's, you know, like this self-realization, self-awareness. Starting to come back.
Well, we kind of see that Mira, Fang, and the little Fanglings have been tracking Spear, and they end up finding where he had fallen over the waterfall. There's a little piece of his like clothing there she finds. Then we catch up to Spear, and now he's at the base of a volcano. And this is why I was thinking that, because it feels like to me he's on his way to this volcano in order to, like, to end it.
Well, I don't think he was intentionally meaning to go to the volcano. He just sort of ended up there, right?
Right, but I'm saying he's there now, and so maybe his point is he's like, oh, this is my opportunity.
I will say I think he just wandered towards the volcano, just ended up there, and was kind of attracted to the landscape and the. What, you know, what was going on off the heat and the scene was just like, where am I? What's going on? And so you think he wandered that direction. I will note there was a moment where he remembered back from season, I think, one, when he fought infected dinosaur that kind of got killed. That was basically a zombie itself, got killed by fire. He had that flashback, and then you saw him kind of longingly look at the lava in front of him. For a split moment, I did think, like, okay, like we have 3 or 4 more episodes left. He's not actually going to kill himself, but it looks like he's thinking about it. But that passed pretty quickly. It was like, but there was that one moment which I thought to myself, maybe he's thinking about it.
Well, he climbs up the volcano, and when he gets near the top, he starts seeing a bunch of skulls on sticks and some kind of something. And then he gets up there, and there is a gray-skinned ape man staring down at him, very lanky-looking creature. And that's where the episode ends.
You don't really know who this guy is, I think. Just some sort of tribal warrior ape guy who apparently has killed a couple of people nearby.
Yeah. I'm kind of holding out that like this is going to lead to voodoo and that voodoo is going to resurrect Spear, but I really shouldn't. I shouldn't really bank on that. I'm just thinking.
I mean, we're at the point now. I think there's 3 episodes left, 10 episodes. I've been working with the 10 episode assumption the whole time.
Yeah.
And it's like, we're starting like, how is this season going to end? You know, is Spear going to die for good? Is he somehow going to gain his humanity back? What does that mean about Mira and their child? Who knows? Like, it's like, these are questions they have to answer at some point.
Yeah, this is not the first. This is basically, he wandered up in a prehistoric fight club. I feel this is not the first prehistoric fight club we've had in the series, right? We've had like several, I think. I don't know. I feel like I vaguely kind of remembered multiple scenarios that could be kind of described like that Spear is kind of wandering into, and this is like yet another one.
Yeah, like, I think the thing I take away most from this episode was that whole sequence with him dealing with the reflections in the cave. I thought that was really the most, like, artistic part of the show, and it was really well done. Again, every episode has been directed by Gendy. I've noticed that. I've been keeping track of him, like, He's done every episode, and it goes without saying, but I might as well just say it since we're talking about it, that he's really a great master of storytelling without words. And there was so much in that scene that came across so clearly, and yet there was no dialogue.
Yes. I know plenty of people argue that he's better without words. And when he starts adding words, it's not as good.
Oh, that's true.
I guess we're taking Unicorn Eternal as an example of that.
Yeah, or like maybe Samurai Jack when they started talking more, whatever. But one of my notes is I noted that I think C. Kohler mentioned this last week, but I noticed the music in this episode, specifically when he was like running from the village people. You know, it's just one of those things that it's got a certain type of soundtrack that it's not gonna like, you know, probably not the type of music you listen to like outside of the show. It's like built for the show, like that sort of soundtrack. But I noted it during that sequence as being, this is actually pretty darn good music.
I think I tend to not notice the music in this show because there's long sequences that don't have music, but it's there. And it's just, I think, done in a way that's very integral to, like, or integrated, I should say, into the story in a way that it's just complimentary and doesn't stand out super strong, but it's not bad either. It's very good. It's just, you know, effective. But enough that I, like, forget it's there a lot of times. So, all right. So that's Primal for this week. Let's move on to the next show, Bleach. The Thousand Year Blood War, Core 3, Episode 13 of 14, so the penultimate episode of this core. The Visible Answer. I think we're talking about Uryu here. All right, so that's how the episode starts out. Yugram catches up to Uryu and they have a chat. Because Yuhabaha is like dormant right now or sleeping, Yugram has his power. And he has that sight with all the goofy pupils in his eyes. And he says that he can see into the future and that he knows that Uryu is going to be, he's betraying them. And, but he kind of says it in a way like he's not 100% sure, but he seems to be able to see into the future and can tell.
And it almost feels like Uryu wasn't even like, isn't like Uryu is probably not even, it does, to me, it felt like Uryu is not like, planning necessarily on betraying Yuhabaha. Maybe he's like conflicted or not certain, but like, you know, I don't think Uryu is like, you know, waiting for a chance to strike necessarily for like a moment of betrayal or whatever. But it almost feels like Yugram sees a future that Uryu is not even aware of. But yeah, there's just broadly like an air of uncertainty. Like no one knows for sure how this multi-site, see the future, past, whatever site. But
I have to admit, I think I took it the other way. I feel like Uryu's plan may have been revealed here. The only part that's curious to me is that Yugram with the vision power can't know for certain. That's the only part that's strange.
I mean, I think part of my, like, this will be elaborated upon a little more next episode, so I won't delve into that. But even when I was first seeing this with new eyes, at least to me, it read a little bit like Yugram may not necessarily have Yuabao's powers, but maybe not the same degree or the same mastery of them. It's kind of the sense I got. Because there were very specific circumstances which Yuabao's powers didn't work. We saw that before. And so I think it might be, that could come into play, but I do think it's, at least the read to me I had at the moment in time when I first saw this was that Yugram maybe doesn't necessarily have the same mastery of said powers that Yuabaha did or has.
That actually makes sense.
And maybe I'm wrong, but I don't get the read that Uryu is like waiting for his moment to strike or whatever. I'm assuming he will eventually, you know, realize his place, but I don't know.
Let me give you something that might change your mind. And it does happen in this episode. I'll point it out when we get to it. All right. Anyway, we cut back and we see that I wrote down Gerard Valkyrie arrives. So this is the guy that has like that helmet on.
Yeah.
And he shows up and I'm like, I'm here to attack you. And he's attacking a whole bunch of people. Yeah. So there's like a fight that breaks out there.
And I'm trying to remember who says this, but there's someone narrating. I think it's a flashback where they're talking. I forget who's talking. Sorry, my memory. But they're like, I hear there's rumors that Pernita is not actually, Quincy, but he's actually the Soul King's right arm. And Gerard Valkyrie is not a you know, true Quincy either. He's actually the Soul King's heart.
Yeah, that's Askin.
Askin, I think, was saying that, right?
Yeah, he says that in a little bit, yeah. But you're right. And while the battle starts to begin, suddenly Renji shows up. And this is kind of leading to the point I was talking about a minute ago. So when they find Renji, he's not dead because remember he was attacked by Uryu. And I forget which character says it. It's not important, but one of them says, oh, the wound, it looks almost as if the person who did it deliberately wanted him to live.
I think it was the big guy with the pink hair who's he was one of the advisors. I'm blanking his name, but I think it was him who said that.
Yeah. So clearly, Uryu, when he attacked Renji, deliberately wanted to immobilize him, but deliberately made it so that he would not die. Now, does that mean that he has a plan? I don't know, but it certainly means he's not on the side of the Quincy's.
Yeah, he couldn't go through with killing.
He wanted to make it appear that he had downed an enemy when he really, in fact, had not. That's the other way to take that.
I mean, I think he saw the same thing when he fought Ichigo. He could have killed Ichigo, I think, if he really tried. But, oh, he just nicked his, what would be fatal wound in anything outside Shonen, but because it's Shonen, getting half your admin gouged out is not a fatal wound. You need to go for headshots or heart shots or whatever. So yeah, so even seeing that, we did his best to put on a good show, but he deliberately didn't kill Ichigo. He deliberately didn't kill Renji.
Right, but the question is, and we won't know till this weekend, was it a show to hide his true plan, or was it that he just couldn't bring himself to kill someone he thought was an ally? We don't know yet. We will find out, I'm sure, next week.
Yeah, that's the question. Is he waiting for a moment to strike and have some sort of plan, or is he just sort of sitting in some position of uncertainty where he's I want to be at the Quincy's, but I can't bring myself to kill Ichigo or Renji, and maybe he's just not sure.
I will say it seems like one choice is a lot more likely than the other, but we'll see.
I don't think so. At the moment, I'm not sure.
So what if he has a plan? What is it?
I'll tell you right now, Crocodile, I am honestly right in the middle. And I think the show will make it obvious, and maybe you're looking at it through hindsight lenses that make it easy to obvious. But for me, I can't tell. I really can't tell which way it's going to go. So anyway, Askin is the one who explains that Gerard is the heart and that Pernita is the arm. And then he uses his weird power again, and he says, I'm going to make it so that all the reishi is poisonous to you. So they all start kind of falling down because the reishi itself, which is overabundant in this area, is now poisonous to the soul reapers. But that's when Yoroichi shows up, and she fights Askin. Now, question, why is she not affected?
She's special.
Face that she wasn't I think near it, and then I think she just came in and did a quick rescue, but
okay,
I think they were the other two were trapped in it more so.
Well, I would be remiss if I didn't point out that she has a sexy new outfit that she debuts in this moment. Now, is this something we've seen before, or is this wholly new?
I mean, that's par for the course for Yoroichi. So
she gets several outfits.
Okay,
cat girl ninja.
Yeah. She's got a skin tight thing on. Looked good. I'm not gonna say otherwise.
And hey, some of the animation during of the attacks she pulled off was pretty darn good. I mean, this show has had good animation kind of throughout, peppered here and there. So
yeah, at the lowest point in this show is good for most shows.
Yes.
But then there are moments when it really skyrockets and it's wow.
Yep.
Anyway, they end up attacking Gerard, and it ends up he falls and he actually gets killed, and there's blood everywhere, and they're kind of shocked. They're like, oh, that guy wasn't that hard after all.
Byakuya is actually trying to play the smart person and be like, we're not even going to give him a chance. I'm going to take my petals on Pakto or whatever and stab him, flood him, just mutilate his dead body. He can't come back from this. And he's just bleeding all over the place. So Byakuya is trying to avoid the trope of letting him, giving him any inch. That turns out that actually probably didn't help.
No, it didn't. We'll learn. But because Gerard Valkyrie has fallen, suddenly there are great earthquakes that are happening everywhere in all of the realms, including Earth, where we do get a very brief flashback to Ichigo's sisters. We never see them, but they're there. Everything's shaking.
Remember when one of those girls, they kept teasing that she had spiritual, sense or whatever, but kind of never doesn't go anywhere.
So. Yeah, somebody in the thread mentioned that, and I was like, that's funny because That's unfortunate that they don't.
It's one of those things that, like, when you're watching like the earliest episodes of Bleach, it feels like it's building towards like, oh, this character is like kind of tapping into their senses and will eventually, you know, realize some sort of ability or power or something, and, you know, kind of grow into some character. But no, it doesn't really go anywhere.
So while everyone's freaking out about the earthquakes, we do cut over and we see Yuhavaha, and he's still in his like semi-sleep state here, but then you just sort of see him smile. Oh, things are going his way, apparently. That's when we get the commercial. We come back. We're back with the fight with Yorichi and Asuken, and that's when Yushiro arrives. Yushiro, who's like the little mini version of Yorichi, and he's kind of like, hey, big sis, I'm here to kick some mutton, blah, 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 and she's kind of like haughty about him.
He just wants to make her proud, or excitedly.
And he actually does a pretty good job of kind of beating up Asuken here. Asuken's not prepared for these attacks.
Yeah, he pulls an aura or Gum Gum Gatling or whatever, however you want to place call it, and basically beats up Asuken pretty good.
And then, unfortunately, though, he does get stuck in the chest with a knife or something, I think.
Well, I think the explanation is like, Asken's power is a little bit strange, and I'm sure it's one of those things that's kind of like vague enough that you could probably explain it however you need to get it to work for the purpose of the story. But he's like, because I was like, you know, attacked with your ability with your soul reaper like power or spiritual pressure or whatever, and because I'm like used to it now, I'm immune to it. That's the phrasing he uses, like, I'm immune to your abilities now. And Yushiro tries to pull it off again, and he's like, nope, doesn't work this time, and then stabs him.
Yeah,
so like they somehow kind of argue that his power to like change like concentrations of whatever, whether it's blood or reishi or spiritual pressure or whatever, they kind of argue that power can be used to become immune, almost like a vaccine, like he's now vaccinated against these abilities. So,
I think that's exactly the word he used. He's now immune to spiritual pressure,
or at least these specific attacks. So
I think someone described it not akin to a JoJo power, and it felt very apt in terms of how his power worked.
Yeah, I saw somebody in the group watch thread saying, like, this doesn't make sense because the attacks are really, it's not the spiritual pressure, it's the impact from the pressure. Like, the pressure is just a pressure, and then there's a wave impact. Like, it doesn't make sense that you'd be immune to the pressure, but I'm like,
don't think
whatever.
About it too hard.
Yeah, I kind of thought that too. I'm like, it probably doesn't matter.
Yeah, I think spiritual pressure is not used in the, like, literal sense of pressure, more like just spiritual power, kind of.
Yeah.
They use spiritual pressure kind of as a catch-all term in a lot of different ways, so.
Well, suddenly, guys, it's now Attack on Titan.
Yeah.
And so it turns out Gerard did not die. He got back up. And the reason he explains, like all Bleach characters explain their powers, he says that he imbues all of the damage that's done to him, and it just makes him larger. So all the damage they did to him just made him giant.
Thanks, Byakuya. You made him a giant.
Yep.
The funny thing to me is during the sequence, he explains this, and then everyone proceeds to do more physical attacks on him. And I'm like, dude, he just told you how his power worked. What are you doing? Try something different, please.
And in the final scene of the episode, we're back to where we were at the beginning.
Oh, before that, I wrote down in my notes, because I thought it was just really amusing. So Shinji and Momo are like attacking him. I think those are the names, right? And they're doing various attacks and whatnot. And then at one point, they're like, we did it! No, you probably did not. That's the least convincing "we did it" I have ever heard. And then they immediately get like swiped.
Yeah. And I guess technically that battle's not over because we cut away from it.
No, and Crocodile said that this battle doesn't really resolve in this Kuur. So.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Okay.
There's only one episode left. So.
Yeah, there's only one episode left, and we can't take care of both Yugram and Gerard, I guess. So.
So we cut back to where we were at the beginning of the episode. We're back with Yugram and Uryu, and they're getting ready. And again, he's asking him the question again. And it's like, so what is the deal? Are you going to betray us? And he says, I know. Why don't I challenge you and find out? And he pulls out his sword and he's getting ready to attack. And that's when Ichigo walks up and he's like, yo. And then Uryu's like, Ichigo. And that's where the episode ends. So we're going to get in the next episode, we're going to finally learn what Uryu's deal is. And we're going to get the reunion of Ichigo and Uryu since their last fight. So it was all right episode, I think, overall. It was kind of typical Bleach is how I describe this episode in so far as like just battle.
It had Uroichi in it, so it was pretty good.
This is true. I agree. And you know what? I want to say that I really like the Yushiro character as well. Like, I really was expecting him to, like, get his ass handed to him right out of the way, especially with Yoriichi kind of giving him, like, the stink eye when he arrived, being like, you know, like you're not going to be able to fight. But then he actually does really good. And I'm like, oh, that was kind of cool.
Yeah, it's nice that when you have, like, a character like that who's overeager but actually is like, oh, I guess he actually does have some competence. It's Bleach, so he immediately gets, you know, kind of flipped it back on him or whatever. But yeah, I guess he could. He's not useless.
No, he's inexperienced enough to not know that he was going to get taken down, but he was powerful enough to actually do damage and impress Yoriichi a little bit, which I thought was cool.
This doesn't really matter, but what happened to Grimmjow again? Like, he was chasing Asken, and I don't quite remember. I don't remember
paralyzed, and I think someone came to tend to his wounds, or was he just like he was paralyzed? He was about to be attacked by Asken. Ichigo intervened. I don't. He might either still
just
be
leave
faced
him there?
On the ground, or yeah. Someone came to help him. I can't remember.
They just I don't left remember him there. Either.
It was a couple episodes ago. They kind of moved away from this group and then came back. So I forget. Oh well, right. Probably doesn't matter.
That's the last thing I want to mention about this episode. This is not really like a big complaint or anything, but I just think it's kind of funny. It's just, I'm thinking like, how many episodes now have they been running towards that castle? You know, yeah. It's been a number, I think.
It's a big courtyard, I guess.
Yeah. Oh, they keep getting stopped too, to be fair. So, okay. Let's move on to the next show. Blue Lock. Blue Lock, Episode 4, Premonition or Intuition? Good question. I think this is referring specifically to our main character. What is his weapon? Is it premonition or intuition? All right. So everybody's in the locker room before the next game. And by everybody, I mean Team Z. And they're all talking about what their weapons are. And I say weapons, of course, in quotes. It's like, what's your special skill? Everybody brings something. Everybody except Isagi, who doesn't know what his special ability is. That's kind of what this episode's about.
I wrote down also that Chiguri, who is the guy with the long reddish hair, he just doesn't want to share what his...
Oh, that's true. Yeah, is he the one that sounds like Senku, who's got Senku's voice?
I'm pretty sure it's... Yeah.
Yeah.
I had the same thought as well. It sounds like the same voice actor.
It definitely is.
Yeah, it's gotta be. It's so much
Aaron Dismuke
in everything he's in, like when he was in Daima too, I just couldn't unhear it. I was just like, anyway, they kind of come up with this idea. They come up with this plan and, they propose this thing called Operation Next Up. It's Me 11, which is basically, they're just going to have each person, use like, their special skill, and then if that doesn't work, then they'll move on to the next person.
I was noting down some of the character names just to help myself.
Oh, go ahead, please help
us wrap my head around them. So the guy making up the plan, who never like opens his eyes or rarely opens his eyes, is Kuon.
Okay,
I'm going by the name that they call them usually, not like both first name surname, but they call him Kuon.
Okay,
yeah, and Chiguri is the guy with the long. That sounds like
him. Okay, gotcha. Before the next game, though, they decide to have a little practice, and they go out and they do some practicing. We also learn during this sequence that 1 week has now passed in Blue Lock.
Mm-hmm.
And I think my notes get a little light here. Basically, the next thing I have written down is that Kunigami says he wants to be a superhero. Oh, that's right.
Yeah, he basically says, thanks for the pass. He kind of notes something that I commented on in the previous podcast where... I mean, this is just kind of the obvious setup, but like he even says, like, Raichi was more open than I was, but you passed to me. Why? And Isagi is like, I don't know. It was sort of like just an instinct or whatever. And, you know, that's obviously what his power is that.
Yeah.
Like he kind of just knows what the best play is, even if it may not be like the best play on paper or whatever. Like it's his instinct, or in other words, his monster that kind of just knows the right. And Kunigami's kind of like asking, not that directly, like, why did you pass to me? And that's why.
And they're kind of talking, they're having this conversation over dinner, and he asks him, like, Kunigami, why do you, this is a weird question. He kind of says it, like, I can't believe I'm going to ask you this question, but just out of curiosity, why did you want to become a soccer player? And he says, I wanted to be a superhero. And he's talking about how, like, soccer, like, inspired him in the same way that superheroes inspire people or something. He wants to be like that, so. And we also learned in this sequence that apparently if you do really good, if you do certain actions in Blue Lock, you get points. And these points can then be traded in for certain perks. So they can like trade up and get like a steak dinner, for example, if they want one.
Yeah, so he basically had points for the goal and he uses that to get steak and he shares it because like, hey, you're the one that passed him, so you get some of the steak.
Yeah, it was nice. It was nice kind of bonding moment between these characters.
Yeah. It's nice that at least one of the other guys isn't just a, you know, a self-centered, you know, airhead or tat or whatever.
Or weirdo. Like, because yeah, the other guy is really, the other guy is pretty nice to Isagi too, but he's also like weird.
Yeah, this guy seems pretty normal. His thing is just that he's big.
Yeah.
Muscle guy. But he's not like a muscle head. Like, he seems actually pretty, you know, he seems pretty, got his head on straight. Nice to have one of those.
So, the match with Team Y begins. They think they're all ready to go, but they're not doing that great. And Isagi's noticing that the defense on Team Y is really, really good. And they just keep doing really well in preventing them from being able to use their Operation Necked Up It's Me thing. And however, he also notices that they end up getting it to this one particular player who's able to easily score on them. And that's when Isagi basically puts it together that this whole time, Team Y had basically been playing them. He'd been basically been setting up Team Z's formation in such a way that it was going to be advantageous to them and that they would be able to score. They thought they were outsmarting Team Y, but Team Y was outsmarting them the whole time.
Yeah, and then probably don't need to go through all the details of the match, but the kind of the broad part of the match is he first focuses on like their scorer. I wrote his name down, but it probably doesn't matter. It's Ogawa, or Okawa, Hibiki. And he's like, that's the scorer that we need to watch out for or whatnot. But then he kind of realizes, no, wait, it's that like bowl cut guy named Nico, who's actually like the key to their team and like who's the heart of it. Yeah. So there's a moment where he like realizes that his monster kind of syncs with like that character, that, you know, opponent, and then realizes he's the one they need to stop.
I mean, I'm going to be honest, like, those two characters were pretty much the only characters in the other team who had, like, even remotely distinctive designs. You know, you have main character syndrome or, like, important character syndrome. So, obviously, they can't exercise that amount of meta commentary, meta awareness in their own universe. But us, the viewers, can be just look at this and see, okay, this and this character are the only ones that matter because everyone looks like just generic NPC number 74 or something.
Yeah, and like you said, once Isagi realizes that Nico is Team Y's secret mastermind, they kind of have like a real brief moment on the field where they're like, oh, I see what you're doing, and I know you're trying to do the same thing, and we're kind of equals right now as far as like trying to outsmart each other. But Team Z sticks with their plan. For the most part, and ends up getting a score in, and they end up getting a point. So it worked. Once they had figured out the Team Y's trickery, they were able to score. And the episode kind of ends there. The extra time bit, this one, is basically a little omake about what everybody eats. I don't really have anything else to say about that. It's just like, I eat this, I eat this, I eat salad, I eat this.
Oh, they were trying to do like trading foods or something.
Those omakes, and then feel like they're really trying.
And someone had like
to chicken, stretch some other value out of what is otherwise not interesting stuff. I can't hear you anymore, guys. Sorry, I'll be right back.
I was wondering, okay, because I was like,
I could hear you, both of you.
My headset died. I can't hear anything. Just a second. Okay, there we go. So, go ahead. I'm sorry, were you saying something?
We were talking about the Crocodile was talking about, you know, the character designs. The kind of like obvious which characters on the other team were at all like worth even.
I did hear that. Yeah.
Then yeah, you were talking about the omake, about the food.
Yeah, I think I was just saying the omake was, I think, Arp Isagi, and then the guy who's underneath him were trying to trade their natto and pickles for the real food the other characters had, but then the other characters swapped their foods and left the Isagi and the other guy in the dust, so they were just forced to eat stuff. So I think that's what happened, right? So.
Yeah, it's kind of forgettable, honestly.
This isn't really important, but I wrote down that the character who wrote the goal, or who scored the goal, his name is like Gakumaru Gin, and he's got like the white hair, kind of in like some sort of like ponytail. His thing is that he's fast.
Yeah.
Well, I was also going to, I wanted to say it earlier, I didn't get a chance to, but when the Isagi's friend was going on about how he wanted to be a superhero, I thought it was going to be some, do some like anti-weeb shit and being like, oh, I love Superman and Spider-Man, but fuck Goku and Luffy or something of that sort. I don't know why. I thought he was my like Westabu kind of thing. That's not how it played out. It was just very sincere, kind of just looking up to his idols and going to grow up. You know, the very normal, natural thing. But I don't know why I thought a Westabu angle is about to pop up, but that's what
I thought that me. Too, for what it's worth, Crocodile. I thought they were going to lean into that and they didn't.
So. There was also one of the characters also like, I guess he approaches soccer as if it's like a woman I'm trying to, you know, impress, or a girl. And it's
that was pretty cringy.
Yeah.
Oh, like, yeah.
It was not, it was like just a minor thing. Like he was just, you know, just a minute. But yeah, I guess that's that character's thing, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. I forgot about that.
Not a big deal. He's obviously on the good guy team, so he'll be around for at least a bit. But yeah, that was pretty cringy.
Okay.
So I won't be able to see Tokyo Revengers, so I just want to say, I've forgotten more about the series than I thought I did, because I like when they put the warning for the, like, you know, this, I'm sure you're gonna talk about there was a special warning for this episode. That I remember, oh right, this is the suicide. But I actually forgot he told him that he was the one who did the, you know, you'll go into it, so I won't spoil it. But I forgot that detail, but I did remember the suicide. So I think there's more about the series than I forgot than I thought I did. So maybe, I guess that might be interesting just in terms of for the rewatch. But
Yeah,
at least props to Toonami for putting that warning there, or, you know, and they did a little, if you, someone needs help, so-and-so, again, I won't spoil the conversation you're about to have, but so I props on them That's for doing fine. That. But yeah, that was certainly maybe a heavier episode than one might have expected at this point in the series, but some shit happens sometimes, so.
Yeah. Any thoughts on One Piece before you go?
One more thing. What's the kid's name, the who grew up to be a cop?
Naruto.
It's Naruto with an O. It's an O at the end.
Yeah, I remarked to myself once when Naruto was like, Takemichi, why didn't you do extrajudicial murder? Like, what's wrong with you?
I noted that too. Like, you're supposed to kill him.
Yeah, very thinking tier out of a police officer. Big think.
Well, it's his sister. I mean, I don't, I'm not advocating for murder, but it is his sister, so.
But I didn't know that. It felt
he's like amongst the last people on the planet who should be saying that, even if it's sister. Like, he should be cool enough headed to be, there are people who can't be saying things like that. Chief amongst them are law enforcement, because for obvious reasons.
Oh yeah, so for sure.
I guess it's a sister, but like, dude, bro.
Blood is thicker than water, and I think he's it's not appropriate, but I can at least understand that, like, he thinks that the person that they're trying to get rid of is like a murderer. So again, I'm not advocating it. I'm just saying I get it.
But yeah, that just stuck out to me given his profession. But yeah.
Yeah. Anyway. I mean, the show treated it appropriately with his response, Takemichi, and is like, huh? What? Did you have any comments on One Piece this week?
What even happened in One Piece? Oh,
there's a party for some reason.
Oh, yes. I also forgot Kinemon and the other dude were actually in this book at all. So it's like, Luffy's like, I'm forgetting something. And then I also forgot them too. It just showed up. So And I was also amused that Robin was obviously one of the more responsible people in the cast, and Brooke and Frankie were all going to stand guard to make sure Kimon didn't sneak on board on the elephant, and then just all fell asleep, and then they snuck aboard on their shitty tiger drawing this time. So,
yeah.
And I guess this monkey's about to warn everyone, so that's, you know, shit's going to go down, I suppose. But yeah, I just forgot about them too, so I don't blame you, Luffy. So I do have to head out. Sorry for not speaking much earlier. Again, there was stuff going on in the background, but I will talk to you guys later.
All right, see ya. Okay, well, let's get into it. Tokyo Revengers. Tokyo Revengers, Episode 4, Return, named because he returns in this episode from the past. But while we're in the past, Hina tells a bunch of loud boys on the train to stop. So she's basically very, very, like, she's a good person, and but she stands up for, like, this elderly woman who, you know, didn't have a seat because a bunch of, like, ruffian boys. And these are, like, little kids, too, but they look like they were, like, in, you know, like, late grade school or something.
Yeah, like, so our main characters are middle school, so these characters are probably, like, 10, 11, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And what I was going to say earlier was I kind of feel like a lot of the topics we mentioned or brought up or kind of were wondering about last week in our podcast episode kind of, like, became, like, you know, relevant in this episode in various ways. So we'll get to that.
Yes, you're right. And like Crocodile said before he left, there at the beginning of this episode, there was a warning about mental health and suicide because this episode does deal with suicide or has it in it. So also, I did notice too, real quick before we continue, that they did play the full opening again. So I think the full opening is a regular thing now for Tokyo Revengers. So. All right. After Hina helps the old lady get a seat on the train, she decides that she's going to tutor Takemichi at her house. So he gets invited over to her house and he's kind of freaking out a little bit because he's like in her room. And, you know, I think her mom comes in. It's like, ooh, you got a boy with you? And she's like, mom, you know, that kind of thing.
I actually didn't mind this scene. Like, this is the sort of scene that I feel like could get kind of weird or creepy. But I actually, it kind of felt like Takemichi, obviously they even bring it up in the scene that he's actually like 25 or whatever, 26. And like, you know, she even mentions like, it feels like I'm speaking to someone older. And he's like, well, I am older, really. But he just kind of is just sort of like, you know, during the scene and they eventually go up on the roof and looking at fireworks, he just sort of like starts to realize, kind of like, you know, he starts to realize it's like, you know what, I really do love Hinata as a person and would do anything for her kind of thing. Like not just merely like an infatuation.
Yeah.
And like that was part of like the scene earlier in the episode too, and also the end of the last episode, right? And so he goes to hold her hand. He's like, this is appropriate, right? I should do this.
Yeah. But whoops. Nato is there. He ends up grabbing his hand by mistake, and that sends him back to the future. I do want to comment real briefly, though, about what you just said, though. The idea that Hina is noticing Takemichi's a little different. I think, too, like there was a moment there where I think Takemichi was thinking, like, I don't want to go back. Why don't I just stay here?
Yep.
Like, he was that infatuated.
Yeah, I think he even says pretty kind of just explicitly, like, in this timeline, Hina is here. In the future, he's not. And he just wants to be with her.
Well, anyway, like you said, he touches Naoto's hand by mistake, ends up coming back to the future. We learn a couple of interesting things here, like you were alluding to. I think these are kind of neat, important things to point out. So while Takemichi is in the past, the present continues to move forward at the same time. So if he spends a week in the past, a week of time in the real time, in the current time takes place. And so you might be wondering, well, what's going on here? Well, his body in the present just kind of goes into like a coma.
I think Naoto literally says like suspended animation.
Yeah.
Is the way they dubbed it.
And it's kind of like his body's alive, but his soul or his mind or whatever is gone. He's an empty shell. And you can even see that, like, Naoto had kind of like IV drip, like, connected to him, stuff to kind of keep him, you know, healthy while he's in this state.
Yeah.
Because obviously he would have to eat and things. And so I'm probably giving him, like, intravenously food and stuff. And that's when we get the scene where, like, you know, he's like, oh, I met Sano, and he's actually a nice guy. And he's like, wow, you didn't kill him. And
yeah, I noted this down also that Crocodile mentioned. He's like, you're supposed to kill him. I'm like, wait, he was supposed to kill him? I don't remember that part of the deal.
Yeah. And they're like, well, okay, so something must have changed then. He's like, either I think you and I are on the thought that it's the other guy that's the bad guy. But I think I'm getting the impression now that Sano may have changed.
Well, there's a lot of things to touch on here. So they start talking about Akun Sendo, which is the redhead kind of character. And we were actually wondering, like, is this character, like, important or not? And the answer is yes. And also mentioned, and you mentioned also, that, like, he pulled out a knife. And then nothing happened with it in the last episode. I'm like, that's interesting that they, like, animated that, like, him pulling out a knife. This just other character. And there's a reason why they did that, because apparently in, like, the prime timeline, if you will, he ends up stabbing that 15-year-old bully character, big guy. So that no longer happened. So that's when we're talking about something changed, this is, like, the major change that we're, I guess, focused on right now is, since he never stabbed that guy and, you know, never, you know, got arrested or whatever, or for that, this Akun character has become a part of the Tokyo Manji gang as, like, a subordinate to Mikey.
Mikey Sano, so, yeah. Interesting thing to point out here. I don't want to go too much into it because I think there's still, we still need to get more details on this. A little strange that both Takemichi and Naoto know this. And I think the impression is that because they're connected through this time loop ability, that they get to keep their memories.
Oh, yeah.
It's a little strange that they get to keep their memory. Now, I can totally understand it from a typical time travel plot that the time traveler himself gets to keep these memories, but apparently so does Naoto. So,
yeah,
a little strange. But again, Naoto is also someone who was previously dead. So and there is some kind of weird connection that they shake hands. So,
yeah, that's a satisfying enough answer for me. Like, obviously, anyone else in the world, if you told them Akun stabbed a guy 10 years or 12 years ago, and, like, wait, no, he didn't. Like, what are you talking about? Because that's a reality that never happened, where these two characters are aware.
Yeah, I'm going to assume it's just these two, and that nobody else is going to have any memories of a alternate timeline. Okay. Well, anyway, Naoto's like, okay, well, if you want to get closer to Sano, you've got your friend. Why don't you try getting, your friend is now a higher up in the Tokyo Manji. Why don't you go try to meet him? And he still has his phone number and everything. He's like, I'll call him.
And there's a scene where he goes to his apartment and it's just to get the phone number. But he's like, his apartment is, you know, a 25-year-old bachelor living by himself.
But, like, really bad.
Yeah, like he's got, like, trash bags just everywhere. Naoto even puts on, like, a mask because he can't. You know, it's kind of just a gag.
But it's also, I didn't realize when we saw him in the first episode that it was that bad. We saw they animated cockroaches, like, crawling around on the garbage and stuff, and I'm like, wow, he was really in that bad a shape. Oh my gosh.
Like, I live alone. I promise you, my apartment does not look like that.
No, I don't know. I'm much cleaner than something like that. That would annoy me. But I guess he's a little more lax than that. So,
but again, the whole point of that scene was just to get the phone number, really.
Right. And he ends up calling Akun Sendo, and he calls him. Finds out that Akun, now he runs a hostess club. And so they show up, by they, I mean Takemichi and Naoto. They show up at the club, and then, of course, the maitre d' guy there, or whatever you would call that guy, is like, okay, here's all our ladies, and which one would you like to have a nice time with? And he's like, no, I want to meet your boss. I want to meet Akun. And he's like, really? Okay. And then he kind of goes in, they go into the back room, and then Akun is sitting there, and he's been wait. He says he's been waiting for Takemichi to eventually show up one day.
Yep. Because they reference like a discussion they have.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, what do you want? What do you think we're going to talk about 10 years from now? And this is it. So
here's another thing. Again, I'm sorry. I'm not going to delve too much into the time travel stuff because it can easily break down in shows. But here's the thing that's weird. Again, time traveling, the time traveler. So sometimes this happens in time travel stories and sometimes it doesn't. It's not happening in this show that when Takemichi returns to the present, he doesn't suddenly have the memory of his altered life. So I was thinking during this scene, it's like, oh, so when did Takemichi last talk to Akun in the past? We don't know. And apparently even Takemichi doesn't know.
Right.
But he should technically know because it was his life now. But anyway.
Because in the prime timeline, whatever, Akun stabbed a guy. And I guess he didn't like remember this. Like, wouldn't he have remembered that?
No, that's what we were saying a moment ago, is that I think he has no knowledge of the previous timeline. Only our time traveler does. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's just, it's.
But it goes both ways, is what I'm saying, is that Takemichi has. He has past timeline memory, but he doesn't have altered timeline memory. It's a little weird. Okay. Yeah. Anyway,
but this scene gets a little bit weird. So they talk about a lot here. There's a lot to talk about here. One of the things that Akun mentions, and I was not expecting this, he's the one who pushed Takemichi onto the train track.
Yes. And like, that was the biggest revelation.
I did not expect that. We talked about it last week. Like, maybe he pushed himself like in some sort of self loop because he had to, kind of thing.
Yeah.
But no. And I don't. We don't know why he pushed Takemichi. And
other than again, he was told to. Well, he was told to.
Oh, I didn't realize he was told to. I must have missed.
Yeah, he was told to by his superiors.
But this is sort of weird because, like, this is where time travel gets goofy, because like in that timeline he was not a member of the Tokyo Manji gang. He was arrested because he stabbed a guy, right? But now in this timeline he's got a different position, but he it's weird because it was like the original timeline when he was not a Tokyo Manji member where he pushed Takemichi.
Oh yeah,
but now in this timeline he's a different person in a different place, but he remembers pushing him, and it's like, wait, how does that work?
Right. Yeah. You could argue that he still wasn't the original pusher, technically.
Yeah, possibly. Right. And I think,
I don't think the story's smart enough to go there, but we'll see.
Yeah. Anyways, so we don't know why he pushed or like who, you know, that's to be revealed, I suppose.
Well, we did see somebody sitting in an alleyway looking very menacing, and I couldn't tell who that was.
And then he also, this part is a little bit, besides the time travel stuff, this part is a little bit contrived to me, just a little bit, where he's like, Naoto was there, and he like knew that you were going to be pushed, so he saved you. And there's no way that he could have known that, except if you have time travel. Like, wait, that was a...
That's the leap, yeah.
Yeah, that's not the conclusion. If I saw someone save someone from a train, even with like impossible reflexes, I wouldn't immediately go, they must have time travel. It would seem like very awkward and, you know, maybe supernatural. But the fact that he like immediately like concludes, aha, it was time travel, right? You have time travel powers. Like, wait, that's a leap. Like, I'm not entirely sure how you came to that conclusion, even though you're right. Like, that wouldn't be the conclusion I came to if I saw that, but whatever. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, I agree. His justification as being like, oh, there was no way he could have known to be there just in time to save you doesn't really hold water.
Yeah, like either. Clearly he sees this action of Naruto, and he I guess properly sees that it's like somehow supernatural. But yeah, I wouldn't come to time travel.
No.
Anyways, he comes to that conclusion correctly. But this is the part that I have written down in my notes here, you talked about earlier, like, did Mikey change, like, in the future or not? But, Akun says here that he hasn't seen Mikey in years. So, like, he's taking marching orders from the other guy, Kisaki.
Correct.
So it seems to me, and this is where the last episode was kind of going, and we talked about this, like, maybe Mikey Sano, there's actually two components to this, because he also mentions, like, he was never the same after Dracoon died.
Yes.
So, like, that seems to be, like, the next, you know, thing to...
Well, we learned in this episode that Akun and Sano died.
Yes. But, like, the way that it seems to me is that, like, it still seems this episode and the previous episode is really building as, like, Mikey Sano is not the antagonist. It's the other guy.
No.
It's the Kisaki, whatever his first name, guy, that he's, like, the source of all the problems. And that's basically the same conclusion Takamichi came to in the last episode. Like, he's the guy we need to worry about. A lot happens in the scene. I'll just jump to the end for now real quick. We can come back. Is that it seems like the next mission for Takamichi is to figure out, like, how to prevent Dracoon's death. Like, that seems to be...
Mm-hmm.
Now, I guess I don't know. Was he killed when he was at middle school? Or was that later? I'm not sure. But that seems to be an important event to keep in mind.
Yeah, Takamichi basically vows now. He says, I'm not just... Now, my plan isn't just to save Hinata. It is to save all three. I need to save all three of these people's lives. Right before he makes that declaration, though, this is when, you know, Akun is basically... And this is a part maybe you can help me understand a little better, because I didn't quite get it. But he was basically saying that he's Kisaki's slave.
Yeah.
And that, you know, he's not very happy. And then that's when he leaps off the building, because they've been standing on the roof the whole time talking. So that's when he walks off and then dies, and we see his dead body.
And yeah, they don't hide anything. Like,
no,
we don't see him fall. But I was not necessarily expecting them to show, like, the actual body,
dead body,
like, on the ground within a pool of blood. Like, oh yeah, there's no ambiguity here. That character is committed suicide.
So interesting that, like, the time travel did give this character a different life, but it ultimately took his life. Now, my question is this. I don't remember, maybe I was taking notes or something, but I don't really remember what exactly it was that Akun felt brought him to the precipice of needing to take his life. Like, what was the deal? Was he just trapped?
He mentions that he hasn't seen Mikey in years, and he felt like he was just at the beck and call of the other guy, Kisaki. And maybe he was, even though he was, like, the head of this hostess bar or whatnot, maybe he was basically just, you know, being... Every component of his life was being controlled by Kisaki, evidently.
Mm-hmm.
And he's just like, I can't do this anymore. I can't get out of this guy's, you know, reach or grasp. And I have no out. I can't get out of this situation. The only thing I can do is kill myself.
I wonder.
So it feels like it's basically he's being completely overwhelmed by the level of control that this Kisaki character, who we haven't really seen. We've seen glimpses of, but this Kisaki character has over him.
I also thought maybe there was a little bit of, like, guilt for having tried to kill Takamichi.
Oh, yeah.
And failing. I don't know if that was a part of it either, but yeah.
All right. Probably contribute.
Anyway, yeah. So, like, yeah. I mean, this is what I was expecting to happen in the show, so I'm not like, this is amazing. But, like, I do like to see it play out, that what we were describing about the fact that he can go back and change the past, but it doesn't always mean everyone's going to have a good future. And this is one example of that, where, you know, Akun in the previous timeline never became part of the gang. And, you know, I don't know what his life was like, but he certainly probably was alive.
Yeah, it doesn't fully explain it, but, like, obviously he would have been, like, a juvenile, you know, arrested for, I don't know if it was murder or just assault. Like, I don't remember why
the assault
died or not, but, like, obviously that's,
he went to prison or something. I think he went to prison.
I don't remember, but still, like, the key point is it was a dramatically different life because of Takamichi's actions.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's going to probably continue to happen with all his other friends, probably to a certain extent, or at the very least with certain characters. So, all right.
And, like, we were talking about in the last episode, like, I wasn't sure if his friend group was going to be, like, you know, important or not. And they'll probably each have a role.
I was going to say, we're probably going to get an episode for each of them, right?
And how their lives were affected. And I assume, you know, this the way that stories are usually written, things are going to get worse before they get better in terms of like the meddling in the past. You know, he's trying to save Hinata's life, and now he's made everything worse, and like he's got to fix it or whatever. That seems
Anime version of the butterfly effect.
Yeah.
Basically. And it's like, I can imagine, I'm not saying this is going to be a thing, but I'll just say it right now in case I'm right. And then I can say like, oh, I knew it. But I can imagine a formula where each episode is going to feature an alteration to one of his other friends' lives. And then we go to the future and we see how they are different. And that would be like, we'll do that for each character, you know. But all right. Overall, I really liked this episode. I like that they answered a lot of the underlying questions. I think it's the surprise with who pushed him, even if it doesn't make 100% sense. I do like that because I certainly didn't see that coming. Overall, pretty good.
Yeah, just don't think too hard about like the time travel. Like, what would you know and remember? I think if you think too hard, it probably doesn't hold water, but. I think at some point you just kind of have to let it be.
I'm used to it, but I'm just like, I like to point it out because I love like dissecting that stuff. It's fun, but it's not, even if it is like convoluted, it's still enjoyable to watch. So, all right. Well, we got one more premiere this week to talk about. So let's talk about it. One Piece. One Piece episode 766, Luffy's decision. Sanji on the brink of quitting. All right. Luffy tells Peckhams that Big Mom can be his subordinate. Or Luffy tells Big Peckhams that Big Mom can become his subordinate, not the other way around.
Yep.
He's not going to become Big Mom's subordinate. Big Mom will become his subordinate. And this, of course, makes Peckhams go crazy. And he explains the risks. He says, no, you don't understand.
Yeah, so let me see if I understand this properly. Basically, they said in the last few episodes, like, no one, you know, turns down an invitation from Big Mom. And the reason why, like, the real explicit, tangible reason why is if you do not accept the invite, she will send the head, like, the beheaded head of someone you know, as, you know, kind of a warning, almost like a gift, only in the worst type of gift possible. So it's just basically, they even kind of, I think Peckhams is even musing, or I forget who is musing, but it's like, it could be one of you, or it could be someone from like the Barate, you know, back in Sanji's past. And then Nami even kind of supposes to herself, like, oh, I bet this is what that tall tongue guy probably mentioned to him. You have to accept or else someone you know is getting killed. So that's the reason, is if he does not accept, someone will get killed. And you could probably argue, like, well, most of Sanji's friends could probably, like, defend themselves to some degree, but probably not everyone. There's, you know, like, he doesn't want to put anyone in harm's way because he doesn't want to go to this wedding. So
Yeah, and they kind of answer here a little bit some of the things you were wondering about, too, specifically the fact that the reason the wedding is happening, and Peckhams lays it out with no ambiguity, is that it's a purely political move to have the Vince Smokes and the Big Mom family join forces. So this is why Sanji's been called back. This is why his wanted poster said only alive. The Vince Smokes and the Big Mom family, they want this joining here.
Yeah, he even
It's not about the Straw Hat Pirates. It's about these two.
Yeah, I think they kind of implied earlier that, you know, maybe it is about Straw Hat Pirates. But yeah, they say pretty explicitly it's about the Charlotte family and the Vince family being, you know, connected.
Right. They want to join forces and they'll do this through marriage. And then one of my notes here says Luffy wants to leave Sanji alone. I don't remember that. He must have said that.
I wrote in my notes, Luffy wants to crash the wedding.
Oh, he does say that, though. Yeah.
We talked about this earlier. Like, he kind of... Luffy is being a little bit uncharacteristic of himself, where he's like, we can't take everyone. You know, I don't want to, like, cause a big battle, but I want to crash the wedding, so I'm going to go, like, maybe by himself. I'm not sure what his plan is. He probably doesn't have much of a plan, but we were talking about in the last episode, like, he actually does want to be not just, you know, let's charge in their front doorstep, all of us, all together. Like, no, let's... I just want to get Sanji and get out of there. Like, yeah. Oh, okay, Luffy actually is... You know,
it is uncharacteristic of him.
A modicum of, you know, I don't know, sense about the ramifications otherwise.
Right. And that's when Cat Viper and crew show up. And he garchus Luffy and Zoro and breaks a bunch of things.
Somewhere around here, also Law shows up and basically... They kind of catch him up and like, here's everything that happened. And Law is like, how dare you? Or how can you let Sanji, you know, do this or get away? And like, I didn't mean to. Sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. Law and that's what happens right after the commercial break. The Law and the pirates show up. And there's a funny, well, I don't even want to say funny. There's just a bit that happens where Law is like, the heart pirates are like excited and stuff. And then Law's kind of putting them down. And they just keep yelling, not cool, not cool, not cool, over and over.
Yep.
And then Law warns of Zo's danger, basically saying that, you know, I should have taken better notes on this. I don't remember what he's saying there. Something about Zo is in danger.
They show the elephant a few times, so I was wondering if they were going to have another one of those, just like, the elephant sucks up water and snouts it everywhere again. But I guess that's just a regular thing, right?
Yeah,
the minks are not that.
I forget what he was talking about here. That's just bad notes on my part.
Well, the thing I have written next in my notes is the part with the samurai, that crocodile man. I don't know if anything happened before then.
Well, you're skipping over the most important part of the episode where everybody has a big barbecue and lasagna party.
Yeah. For a split second, I was like, wait, what did I forget? Oh. You're joking.
No, it's stupid. Okay. It's just a long sequence of them just having a party, and then everybody goes to sleep. Like, in like pure cartoon fashion, everyone just goes to sleep at the same time.
I even have written in my notes, they have a party for... It's kind of random. Oh, okay.
And then we get to the part where Brooke, Robin, and Frankie go to stop the samurai from re-entering Zo, and they go like to watch. And then I also was kind of surprised. I did remember it when it happened, but I was surprised that like the diligent Robin, the most mature of all the Straw Hats, also fell asleep. They all fell asleep.
I even was wondering for a moment, like, did they get like poisoned or like some sort of like sleep? And they're like, no, they just fell asleep.
They just fell asleep.
Good job, Robin. we thought we could trust you.
No.
And look what that got us.
And then, they get in. Kinemon and his friend, whose name I forget at the moment, they get in and they start walking through the city. And then that little ape is with them. And then the ape starts running away and trying to warn everybody. I wrote down that the ape yells, "The samurai have ape-peered. Ape-peered." This little monkey guy speaks in monkey puns constantly.
I wonder if the puns are better in Japanese. I don't know.
Maybe.
I actually wrote down one of the samurai's lines. They're talking to the monkey and he says, "Why are you perspiring so profusely, my friend?"
Yeah. That I think the thing here is, and this, I don't know this, but this is the impression I get. I think that in the original Japanese, the samurai, the characters from Wano, all of the characters from Wano just speak in like an old style Japanese way of speaking. And so I think this is the English equivalent where they have these very like weird ways that they talk where it's like
kind of flowery,
old fashioned, right? And it's like, you appear to be profusely sweating, my dear friend, you know, that kind of thing.
Profusely perspiring.
Yeah. I mean, Kinemon's been doing it since day one. I think the idea is that the samurais just speak old. They speak old, an old way of speaking. Yeah.
I think we mentioned this. I think one of us literally mentioned this similarly, but I know like Rock Lee and Naruto speaks in a very polite manner in Japanese. Yeah. Like, you know, something about how he puts words together is just very polite. like extremely excessively cartoonishly polite. In English, the way they translated that is he never spoke a contraction.
Yes.
Ever. And like, yeah, is that one-to-one? No, I don't. It's impossible to be one-to-one, but they have to come up with some way to kind of
right. represent. Yeah, I think, that. Again, that's what I'm saying. That, so. It's like what we've also talked about when like people who are from like, who have the Osakan dialect in Japanese. Yeah,
Southern.
They have the Southern dialect in English. Yeah, it's like they've got the Megami. Southern accent. It's not a one-to-one, but it's close, you know?
Yeah.
All right. And that is it for One Piece. The samurais have ape-peered. So we'll see where this goes. All right. Do we want to talk about flavor alerts?
Play flavor alert.
Potential award nominations.
Anything jump out to us this week?
Anything in Primal as like that's especially notable. The scene with his like self-reflection in the waterfall was kind of nice, but is that like a moment? I don't know. Good moment.
I don't even want to go as far as to say like even as much as I liked the moment when we learned that Akun had pushed him, that's not like a best moment. That's just sort of, or a big surprise. That's just sort of like a really good bit of storytelling.
Yeah, it was unexpected. Predictable. Right. And it didn't necessarily felt like it was like, well, that's the problem with like storytelling. If you try to catch like the viewer or the reader off guard, you don't want it to feel like it just comes out of nowhere and feels, you know, nonsense or impossible. But you don't want it to be like super predictable and like everyone saw it coming either, right? There's a good balance that you want to reach in terms of like be unpredictable but not out of nowhere. Like, but so, and I feel like this was a pretty good, you know, like, you know, it's not unbelievable that this character who hasn't, you know, that he pushed Takemichi. We don't know why, but it's not like it feels like. Anyways, yeah, not really a best moment. In terms of like best character, best voices, I still think we can hold off on that a little bit for these two shows. I know we're four episodes in now, but you know, we're not in a hurry. We can wait.
Agreed. Yeah, nothing's jumping out to me. The Blue Lock stuff, like you could nominate. It's not a name though, but I was going to say next up, it's Me 11 is like a terrible name, but that's not a name of a person. It's just like a stupid name for their dumb.
Yeah.
Well, it wasn't a dumb plan, but it was a dumb name for a plan.
And they realized it was a dumb name. We were supposed to think it was.
That's true. I guess.
I mean, I'm not saying that makes it worse or different. It's just that it was kind of like an intentional
name. Yeah, you're right. They did. I think someone mentioned it was stupid sounding. Yeah. Oh, by the way, I didn't mention it either. They ended up changing the name of it to Next Up, It's Me 9 later in the episode.
Yeah, because two of them. I almost feel like we have to nominate like Hinata as like best female character just because
let's go ahead and do it. I'm already won over by her, frankly.
Yeah.
She's been her pretty great.
Her actions, especially in the previous episode.
And
like the scene where they're in her bedroom earlier. Like, she was sort of embarrassed by her mom, but I'm kind of glad it wasn't, like, overkill where she's like, oh, my God, I'm bringing a boy into my bedroom. Oh, my God, this is so weird. Oh, my God. Like, I'm glad it didn't go that way.
No, it was more like, you know? Mom, get out of here.
Yeah, it felt a little bit more normal.
Yeah.
So.
What's her last name?
Whatever it is, it's the same as Naoto's. I don't know his last name either. I know they've said it. I will mention, in terms of voices, I don't know if it's necessarily excellent or good, but they're doing a good enough job where it's not super distracting to me. I believe it's AJ Beckles is the voice of Isagi in Blue Lock, I think. And he does a lot of like just the way the show is and the way the character is talking to himself, kind of like,
yeah,
you know, and I think he does a pretty good job at that. I mean, it's, again, it's not amazing, but you know, that, To do that sort of like effort to like having to like, you know, do all this muttering to yourself and like, he does this, then I do this, it's the plan and blah, blah, blah. Yeah, you know, that's a lot of acting you have to do. So
that's fine. I go ahead and add him for now.
I mean, he is the main character. So
yeah, I think the voices overall in general on this show are pretty good. It's It's more that just the problem I have with the show is the characters. They're yeah. kind of one note and yeah, very cliche. I'm not hating Blue Lock, but I don't enjoy it either. I just sort of like, all right, it's Blue Lock and maybe there'll be a funny moment in it, but mostly it's just soccer. And a lot of like, the show is very much, and again, we've talked about the Food Wars relationship, and Food Wars did this too, but I think this show does it way more, where it's like you were saying, is there's so much exposition, and usually it's like inside the head exposition,
yeah,
where somebody's just talking in their head aloud about everything that's happening.
Yeah, like that's basically what I was getting at. Isagi is basically explaining the whole soccer match.
Exactly.
So
everything that happens gets explained, and rather than being shown, it gets explained.
Anything in Bleach worth nominating? No.
I mean, the only thing is, I liked Yorichi's little brother, but I don't know if it's enough to nominate him. I just thought he was kind of cool.
And it's not really, I don't think the fight was long enough to really be called like a fight. It was just like one attack and then a counter. Okay. Maybe we can put in like best power and ability, Eskin's ability or Gerard Valkyrie's ability. Do we still have that category? I forget.
We do. I don't know if I feel strongly about those.
I don't know. I was just suggesting.
I think the Gerard's ability is kind of cliche.
Yeah.
And the Eskin one, honestly, I don't hate it, but I don't get it.
It's also kind of, it's kind of bullshit. Whatever. It's
like, what is your deal?
Like I said earlier, it's sort of explained by like changing the concentration of power or whatever as a vaccine, but yeah, whatever. It's so vague that you can kind of just argue that it explains how he can do whatever. Sure. Okay. Yeah. I don't know. Maybe we can just leave it at that.
Okay. Fair enough. All right. Well, that'll do it for this episode of the Toonami Escape Podcast. Thank you for being here, Seda.
Yep. No problem.
And again, thanks, Crocodile, for being here earlier. We'll be back next week for the season finale of Bleach. So look forward to that. And then the following week, Rooster Fighter, which also had a new promo come out. Oh, by the way, one last thing before we go. We were wondering, does Rooster Fighter have a Japanese language audio? And it does. I don't know if they're showing that. The schedule doesn't show that they're going to play it in Japanese, but it does have a Japanese soundtrack or Japanese audio track.
Okay.
Because I saw a promo in Japanese where all the characters are speaking in Japanese. So that is a thing. Anyway, until next week, later.